The year is 2000. The scene, the quiet and tastefully decorated Los Angeles office of housing consultant Harry Robinson.
Thank you for calling. Bye. Well, as newlyweds, this finding a place to live must be an entirely new experience for you, Mr. and Mrs. Fleming.
It certainly is, Mr. Robinson. I lived my entire life in the same old Bermuda Modern. My family has had it for three generations.
How about you, Mr. Fleming?
Well, Dad's with the State Department, so we traveled a good deal. I guess I lived most of my life in Dad's briefcase.
As you know, the single-dwelling home is out of the question. They're as scarce as hen's teeth and as obsolete as the motor-driven automobile. There's an entirely new concept in housing today, the apartment center.
Oh, Jim and I have no illusions about having our own little bungalow. An apartment center would be fine. One of those with a hobby shop in the basement for my ceramic work and a woodworking shop for Jim.
Sue, you're dreaming.
Oh, no. Mrs. Fleming's quite right. Apartment centers have all those things. Music rooms, hobby shops, playgrounds. Actually, they're a combination home, recreation center, and vacation resort.
We'll be glad to go out and look at whatever you have available. Like it to be close to Los Angeles, though. I want to be near my work.
Mr. Fleming, perhaps I should explain. We housing consultants no longer go out and show homes. The way buildings spread out, it would mean covering an area of several hundred thousand square miles. What we try to do now is determine in advance what kind of home a client needs and then bring the home to the client.
Is that why we filled out that form, which asked how much space we needed, what we wanted to pay, our hobbies and business and all that?
I hope we didn't get too personal. That information you gave us was fed to our home selection computer. It's evaluated your needs, your interests, your temperaments and personalities, and the price you can afford to pay.
Did it make a recommendation?
Yes, here it is. The Moon Vista, one of our newest listings.
Oh, I like the name. Where's it located?
About 100 miles from here, near Bakersfield. It's the last of the close-in property.
100 miles away? That wouldn't be bad, Jim. You could fly to work in about 20 minutes.
Oh, I'd give it a half hour. There's that bad air traffic bottleneck over Burbank.
Oh, I'm sure we'll like it, Mr. Robinson. Can we see it first?
Like I said, Mrs. Fleming, we bring the home to you. We'll take a look at Moon Vista right here on our television home scanner.
Does commuting 100 miles in 30 minutes to the office startle you? Well, it shouldn't, according to the experts. And the housing consultant will be a very important part of the scheme of things in the year 2000. Mr. George Vernon Russell is head of the Los Angeles architectural, engineering, and planning firm that bears his name. Mr. Russell says,
a couple of tomorrow find themselves in the year 2000, happily ensconced in their garden apartment. The great population growth and higher taxes will virtually eliminate the single-family dwelling. But Sue will be intrigued by the ceramic shops and music rooms in the recreation section of the apartment center. Jim will enjoy the hobby shop for the tenants to work in, stocked as it is with that rare, outmoded building material, wood. Together, they'll enjoy the underground gymnasium, badminton courts, and pool. And there'll probably be space in the underground area not only for the family jet car, but for Jim's sports plane.
The year is 2000. The setting, a garden apartment in a 500-family dwelling center in suburban Los Angeles.
Mom, I got it. I got the job.
Oh, good for you, Mary. Tell me about it.
Oh, it's so exciting. I start Monday, and guess what? I'm secretary to the president.
My daughter's secretary to the president of Nuclearonics. I'm so proud of you, Mary. Tell me, what's he like? Is he handsome?
He's very efficient, a real brain.
Well, he'd have to be to head up a big organization like that. Now, is he married? A widower?
Oh, Mom. You just won't give up for me, will you? Well, I hate to disappoint you, but he's not eligible, and I'm not interested in him.
Well, that's your trouble, Mary. You won't let yourself get interested in men.
I guess I really shouldn't call him a he. That's not proper.
Nor respectful.
Or grammatically correct, either. He's more like an it.
A what?
An it, Mother. It wouldn't be correct to call the president a he because he's not a person. It's a thing, a computer.
Your boss isn't a human, he's a machine?
Mother, you act so surprised. You know about computers replacing people. It's been going on for years.
Well, I know that.
But having a machine as a president of a large firm, it just doesn't seem right.
You're so old-fashioned, and he's not just a machine. The president is one of those latest electronic marvels, a computer executive. He's perfectly capable of doing everything a top executive must do. Plan, create, think, make decisions, and give orders.
Oh, it's weird, Mary. I don't like it.
It makes sense, Mother. A firm like Nucleotronics, which deals in atomic power, can't afford human error. The president must make faultless decisions. There's too much at stake.
Well, I guess I'm still a bit old-fashioned, my dear. I like the idea of the boss being a human. And I'm not so sure I want my daughter acting as a secretary to a gadget.
Oh, Mother, I'll still work with humans. All the vice presidents are very much alive.
Well, I wonder how these men feel, knowing that a machine stands in their way to the top. And personally, I'd resent it so much I'd quit.
They're very happy, Mom. And they all have great responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. Like oiling and dusting this mechanical monster.
Mother, you're still prejudiced. Suppose I told you the executive vice president is in his early 30s and a bachelor.
Well, what's wrong with him?
Nothing, Mother. He's very nice.
Well, now, is he a human?
Oh, very much so. And he likes fried chicken.
Oh, he does, huh? Well, perhaps he'd like to try mine sometime.
Oh, he wants to.
Well, that wasn't being very polite, Mary. You should have asked him over for...
Dinner. I already have, Mother.
Well, you might just as well ask the president to come along, too. The poor thing, it's probably never had fried chicken. When did you say you started, dear? On Monday?
Well, perhaps that little playlet is a trifle exaggerated. After all, it would be difficult imagining anyone in the year 2000 who wouldn't realize the important part computers will play in big business. Dr. Gilbert D. McCann, head of the Department of Electrical Engineering at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, has this to say about it.
We don't understand human beings well enough to duplicate them, but we can create machines to do the same things that human beings do. And by the year 2000, with a greater knowledge we will have about the properties of materials, we should be able to reduce these artificial intelligences to miniature size, so that conceivably, doctors might carry their own computers to help in the diagnosis of a patient's ailments. Or reporters could feed information they gather at the scene of a crime into a small computer, and it might even write the story for them. All these and many more things will be possible, depending on what men choose to do with these thinking machines. One thing seems certain. By the year 2000, men share their work with machines to what now may seem an unbelievable degree.
The year is 2000. The setting, a leading research laboratory in Southern California. KNX reporter David Vail has just entered the office of the managing director.
Hello, Dr. Nagel. I'm David Vail.
Oh, yes. Sit down, Mr. Vail.
Thank you. I'd like to record some comments on your work here at the lab.
Fine. I'm ready when you are.
Well, the recorder's right here in my pocket. There. We're recording now. Dr. Nagel, our listeners are anxious to know more of your remarkable experiments here at the Primate Research Laboratory.
And we are anxious, sir, to keep the public informed. I'll tell you whatever I can.
Well, first, would you explain, Doctor, why you use monkeys in analyzing the growth and development of human intelligence?
Primarily as a matter of expediency and convenience. Monkeys are much more cooperative. And since observations based on comparative tests show that many of the mechanisms and behavioral patterns of the monkey compare favorably with the human child, we believe we can apply the data from these studies to young humans.
Well, are you stating for the record, Doctor, that monkeys are as intelligent as people?
No, but in certain limited areas of behavioral pattern, they are much alike. The trained monkey can do certain things we humans do, and just as well. Moreover, as monkeys are cultured in human environments, it has been observed that the two performance curves overlap more and more. What we're trying to determine is the absolute potential, the summit of monkey performance.
I see. And once these facts are known, they can be applied to human factors?
Right, as clues to human patterns of performance, particularly in the child.
But in order to apply this, wouldn't you have to train a monkey to think and behave like a human?
From the day of birth, selected monkey subjects have been brought up in foster homes under exact human conditions. Every effort has been made to adapt them to a human society. Even their education is similar to that of humans in comparative age groups. Their behavior pattern will be very similar in many things, but their intelligence and judgment is another matter.
Well, do you believe it possible, then, Doctor, given the proper cultural environment and educational opportunity, a monkey could be taught certain skills?
We already have some remarkable evidence along these lines. I want you to take a good look at this painting over here on the wall.
Oh, yes, I've noticed that. It's beautiful. Such force and feeling.
It has been selected for showing at the All California Art Museum.
Well, small wonder. Now, don't tell me that was painted by a monkey.
No, that was painted by my small son. But his companion, I suppose you could say instructor, is one of our subjects here at the research center. A very gifted young orangutan named George.
Sound fantastic? Well, it's not really so strange as it may seem. According to Dr. Stafford Warren, Dean of the School of Medicine at the University of California at Los Angeles.
Laboratory research has already shown us that certain behavioral patterns in monkeys and young humans are much closer than previously had been thought. We feel that this may open to us new vistas in the study of mental and physical health. By careful observation and laboratory study of simians who have been exposed to certain frustrations and strains and rewards, has shown at least one origin of the executive ulcer, as well as many typically human reactions and behavior. We hope gradually, therefore, to be able to find the key to many of the mental problems that beset society. In the year 2000, we may understand and be able to eliminate many of the elements in our growing up period and adult life which cause mental distress and breakdown. Altogether, this is gaining momentum enough to make me very hopeful for the future.
It's long before the year 2000. The setting, a busy heliport somewhere in Southern California.
Cabby, hey, helicab.
Where to, mister?
Yeah. Oh, excuse me, Major. I didn't notice the uniform.
That's okay.
Like I say, Major, where'll it be?
Glendale.
Glendale, your home, Major?
No, Oceanside. But I spent a few years in Glendale as a kid.
Ah. Say, what do you think of all the excitement?
All what excitement? I've been away.
Are you kidding? The man in the moon. You know, one of the boys from your outfit. Russell, what's his name? He's back on Earth now. Can you imagine that?
Yes, I've heard.
It's a pretty good stunt, all right. But I don't know why everyone's trying to make a hero out of him. It's not his fault they sent him to the moon.
Of course not.
You know, some guys get KP, others go to the moon. You know how the Army is.
I believe it was the Air Force.
Well, here's the Glendale fall-off. Now where?
Chevy Chase up to Adams Square.
Okay. The first man on the moon. Boy, I'll bet that guy's living it up tonight. Surrounded by girls, champagne. girls go daffy over heroes. You ever notice that?
I suppose so.
No, I'm not taking anything away from him, but I bet he's just an ordinary guy like you and me.
I'm sure he is.
Imagine, standing there on the moon looking down at the Earth.
Looking up at the Earth would be more like it.
Huh? Oh, yeah, I see what you mean. Anyway, I'll bet he liked to froze.
I don't think so. In full sunlight, the surface of the moon is 240 degrees.
Hey, you boys really are up on this stuff. Well, then how do you suppose he kept from burning up?
Easy. Silicon spacesuit.
Well, I'll be. I just wonder what he thought of being up there. Here we are, Adams Square.
Look, I'm not going anyplace, really. I just want to walk around the block. Will you wait for me?
Well, now, I don't know, Major.
Look. Do you really want to know what he thought of up there on the moon?
Yeah.
1,000 things, because he was so busy. But the one thing he thought about most was a neighborhood where he used to sell papers.
You're not putting me on, are you, Major?
Funny, isn't it? A place he hasn't seen in 17 years. A neighborhood in Glendale at Adams Square.
Well, what? Well, I'll be.
It's not so strange when you think about it. I'll be back in 15 minutes.
Yeah, Major!
Yes?
Look, Major, I don't want you to think I'm a hero worshiper like those crazy dames. I mean, you know, that's kid stuff, but do you mind if I just sort of walk along with you?
Why, sure, come on.
Actually, the day when we send a man to the moon is not too far away. According to Mr. Brian Sparks, deputy director of the California Institute of Technology's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Here's what he has to say.
We today are just entering the space age. Consequently, the problems we face are vast ones, but scientific research is providing the key to many of them. It's only a matter of time, and not too long a time at that, until probably we will succeed in sending a man to the moon and back. By the year 2000, a permanent station should have been established, and very possibly we'll be able to sit in the comfort of our living rooms here on Earth and watch on the telescreen a direct pickup of the explorations of the moon teams. Quite possibly, too, by the year 2000, we will have sent spacecraft to the very fringes of our own solar system, to Jupiter, Neptune, or Uranus.
The year is 2000. Our setting, the lush garden terrace showroom of a major automobile agency.
Hello, folks. Looking for a new car?
Well, yes. Thought we might trade in some of the old ones.
We don't accept trades anymore, but we'll be happy to take them off your hands.
You don't take trade-ins?
Not as such, no. We take them in, give you full value, then send them to the factory where they're melted down. That gets the Conkers, which will do only 300 miles an hour, off the expressways. Matter of fact, that's the law.
I didn't know that.
Then your cars are more than 2 years old, and you really should be in the market for some new ones. Now, what can I show you?
I'd like a blue one.
That isn't what I meant, madam. What are you going to use the cars for? Do you want a single-seater for shopping within a radius of 100 miles? A two-seater for commuting to your summer home in Arizona? A family car to accommodate 8 or 10, or...
First, let's look at single-seaters. We each have to have one. She works in Apple Valley, and I work in Santa Barbara. Sometimes we just get plain tired of taking the helicopters. Like to get back to Earth once in a while, don't you?
I know exactly what you mean, and I have just what you're looking for. Now, if you'll make yourselves comfortable, I'll have it brought in on the conveyor belt. A blue one. Here we come. As it approaches, I want you to notice the lines. Low, smooth flowing, yet compact.
What about the engine?
You have a choice. A combustion engine which operates with 100% efficiency, or an electric. For constant operation and heavy duty, say 150,000 miles a year, I would recommend the combustion engine. Cheaper to operate.
My, it is pretty, isn't it?
Open the door. Look at the interior.
But there's no handle.
Just touch it here. It opens automatically.
Oh, my.
And you'll notice there's a fold-away steering wheel. After all, there may be occasional situations in which you would prefer to manually operate the automobile rather than tie into the electronic system on the expressways.
Nice upholstery.
Yes, and it keeps itself cleaned electrostatically. Plus the fact that you have a choice of 20 different materials, hundreds of combinations. This happens to be a heat-controlled synthetic leather.
Why is the roof made out of glass?
It isn't glass, madam. It just looks that way. It's stronger than steel, made from a plastic material. If you like sun and lots of it, you turn this knob, this one here, to strong. If not, you turn it off and you can still see clearly. But the sun's harmful rays will not hit you.
These cars are air-conditioned.
Of course, fully. I don't like to boost the competition, but there isn't an automobile made today which isn't fully air-conditioned.
Well, now, what about servicing? Would I have any trouble with that?
These automobiles are fully guaranteed for 2 years, which under the law is the life of the car. You never have to service any part of it. In fact, all moving parts are sealed in and the servicing is automatic.
Well, dear, what do you think?
We certainly need them. I think we should get two.
Fine. How long would it take for delivery?
After you decide on the color combinations you want in both interior and exterior, 1 hour. Now, there are 6 other orders ahead of you.
Would it be asking too much to have them delivered?
Not at all. If you'll give me your code numbers, I'll put them in the electronic expressway system, and they'll be in your garage in 2 hours.
Excellent. Oh, while we're here, do you mind if I take a look at the models without wheels?
Why, not at all. There's one right behind you. We keep it on permanent display because there's so much interest in them. They are more expensive, but once you've had one, you wouldn't go back to the old-fashioned wheeled model. Why, I'd be willing to bet that within 10 years, wheels will be completely a thing of the past. The principle of riding on a cushion of pneumatic air has been proven more practical.
Well, maybe next year we can afford them.
Good heavens, what's that?
Why, that's our window display. We have a couple of old-time mechanics working on a 1960 convertible. Remember those? We're trying to restore it as a permanent reminder of the good old days.
But why do they have to make all that noise? And that smell?
Madam, noise and smell are part of the display. It wouldn't be very realistic if they weren't both there. Now, would it?
Sound fantastic? It's not really so when you stop to consider the great stride the automotive industry has made in the past 40 years. Mr. George W. Walker, Vice President and Director of Styling for the Ford Motor Company in Dearborn, Michigan, has this to say in that regard. Mr. Walker?
Thank you, Mr. Goss. Many times the picture presented to us of the future is one dedicated to helicopters and jets. But the fact remains that the majority of people will be depending on a form of automobile for their transportation. Extensive interstate speedways will be virtually accident-free as a result of electronic controls designed to eliminate driver error. New engine advancements will cut operating costs and fewer moving parts, along with more highly developed suspension systems, which will slash repair bills. The future is exciting, and probably as much so for the automotive industry as for any other.
The year is 2000. The scene, the office of a surgeon specialist in one of Southern California's vast hospital clinics.
Ah, do come in, Mrs. Taylor. Have a seat, please.
Will Timmy be all right, Dr. Harper?
Yes, there's no question of it, Mrs. Taylor. But we do have work to do. Your boy has a seriously defective heart, as you know. I won't bore you with medical terms, but the fact is he has to have a new heart.
A new heart?
Precisely. Can be done in one of two ways.
Well, I'm afraid I don't understand. A new heart?
Mrs. Taylor, does the term DNA mean anything to you?
Well, I've heard about
DNA.
It.
DNA. It stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. It's the triggering device in living tissue that determines whether a cell will be part of, say, a stomach or a liver, an eye or a heart. Through our controlled use of the DNA molecule, we can give orders to growing cells so that they will develop into any desired organ.
Are you saying that Timmy can just grow a new heart?
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. But as I mentioned, there's another way. And that's what I recommend in this case.
But what other way, Doctor?
It's just a matter of transplanting.
Oh, well, it sounds terribly mechanical, doesn't it, Dr. Harper?
If you want to, Mrs. Taylor, you can say that the doctor's contribution is mechanical, but I can hardly take for granted the power that allows us to do these things.
Oh, of course, and I didn't mean I'm not grateful.
Well, I'm sure you didn't. But you might be interested to know that it is technically possible to build an entirely new boy from your Timmy.
What a horrible suggestion. I don't want a new boy. I want Timmy just as he is.
Well, I can appreciate that, but you must see my point. He won't be just as he is. He'll have a new heart and be so much the better for it.
Oh. Well, that seems different somehow.
I have a reason for mentioning this, Mrs. Taylor. What applies to Timmy also applies to older people. As various parts of the body become ineffective with age, they can be replaced.
Well, then why does anyone have to die?
Well, there are other reasons besides the wearing out of vital organs. But that problem is being overcome, too. In the meantime, you may well expect to live half again as long as your parents.
Half again? But my father lived until he was 92.
Precisely. And it's quite conceivable that you, Mrs. Taylor, may expect good health until you're 135.
Oh, my.
Sound fantastic? Not completely so, says Dr. Ray Owen, professor of biology at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, California. He adds,
in the year 2000, it's quite conceivable that many worn out and faulty parts of the human body may be replaced fairly readily. It may become routine for a doctor to diagnose aging in a patient, and replacements for certain aging parts may be called for. If the trouble is in the manufacturing of hormones, there may be a transplant of hormone-making cells. Presumably, youth and life will be greatly extended. While this may seem to have about it a certain aura of science fiction, it has a factual basis as well. We are familiar with corneal transplants even now, and blood banks are commonplace. With research and experiment, the day when the successful exchange of a healthy organ for an unhealthy one takes place may not lie in the too remote future.